All right, we're going to start here on the bottom and dial it a bit by the two dots. The Gemara here is continuing to discuss some of the differences that are found between the Aseret HaDibrot that are found in Parshat Yitro versus the Aseret HaDibrot that are found in Parshat Etchanan. Here, it says, Sha'al Rabbi Chanina ben Agil et Rabbi Chia ba'aba mipnei ma b'dibrot rishonot lo ne'mar b'hem tov u'b'dibrot achronot ner b'hem b'hem tov. Why is it by the Dibrot HaRishonot refers to the Dibrot, the Aseret HaDibrot that are in Parshat Yitro, and the Dibrot HaChronot refer to the Aseret HaDibrot that are noted in Parshat Etchanan? As I mentioned in yesterday's daf, it's not a difference between the Luchot Rishonot and the Luchot Shniot, but rather simply, in the Luchot Rishonot, we have two times in the Torah that the Torah described what was written in the Luchot HaRishonot. One time in Parshat Yitro, which is the actual event that takes place, and one time in Sefer Devarim, where Moshe is retelling what took place at Mamad Har Sinai. And those two versions of the Aseret HaDibrot are supposedly reconcilable because they're talking about the same event. The biggest problem between them is Zachor V'Shamor, to which Chazal responds, Zachor V'Shamor B'Dibur Echad Ne'emru, that they were said together. There are other small nuances between the two sets of Dibrot. The Ramban al Torah says that most of them are not meaningful. And here you have one of those differences that the Ramban really calls not meaningful, and just says that whatever is added in Parshat Etchanan is just an explanation of what happened in Parshat Yitro. Nevertheless, here the Gemara is trying to ascertain what is that meaning of that difference. And that is in Parshat Yitro it says, Kaved et avicha v'et imecha. So the only reward that is mentioned in Parshat Yitro for Kabbalat Avim is Laman Yarichun Yamecha Ala Adama. That's the only reward. Whereas in Parshat Etchanan and Sefer Devarim, it says Kaved Et Avicha Ve'et Imecha Kasher Tzivecha Hashem Lokecha Laman Yarichun Yamecha Ulaman Itavlach Ala Adama Asher Hashem Lokecha Noten Lach. So it's not only the man yarichun yamecha, but laman itavlach. And that's the nature of the question over here, which is, how come in the Dibrot that are in Parshat Yitro, it doesn't say laman itavlach? Whereas in Parshat Etchanan, it does say laman itavlach. Amarlo, ad she'ata sho'alani, laman abahem tov? Before you ask me about where it says tov or why it says tov, she'alani im ne'mar behem tov. Why don't you ask me if there is the word tov at all? Im lav or not, she'eni yodea, im ne'emar behem tov, im lav. Says, I really don't know if the word tov appears in either one of these. Klach etz Rabbi Tanchum bar Chanilai, she'ragil etz Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. He should go speak to Rabbi Tanchum bar Chanilai, who spent a lot of time with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. She'abaki ba'agadah. He's a baki in the Agadah, or more familiar with the psukim. And therefore he would know whether the actual Sukkim themselves contain this phrase that you're saying, which is Laman Itav Lach. The nature of his answer is very strange. The Tosafot and Baba Batra take it very literally and say that there are times when they were not Biki'im in the Psukim, meaning that here you have Rav Chia Ba'abo, who is a big Baki in Alocha. They was less familiar with the Psukim versus someone who was a Baki Ba'agadah, who spent most of his time interpreting the Psukim. And so that on a very, very basic level, and the simplest way to read this is that he really did not know what was written in the Psukim. And therefore he says you should check with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi or those that learned by Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to get a better understanding. The other Mefarshim are more loath to explain it in that way because it seems like everybody in their day knew the Mikra. If you were involved in learning, you knew all the Mikra by heart and you would have been aware of this difference. So the Maritz Chayut, Maritz Chayit brings down two answers possibly here. The first answer, which he says, is that the word Laman Itavlach, it's not clear what the meaning of Laman Itavlach is. Because Laman Itavlach can have two possible meanings over here. Laman Itavlach could be because if you perform Kibud Av Va'Em, your children will see you performing Kibud Av Va'Em for your parents, and therefore they will act in a similar manner towards you. So that there is this Midah Keneged Midah, and Laman Itavlach is that if you do Kibud Av Va'Em for your parents, then your children will do Kibud Av Va'Em for you. That's one possible interpretation. I think the Abarbanel brings such an interpretation down. The other possibility is Laman Itavlach, the way Chazal interpreted it, is Laman Yarichun Yamecha, and then Be'olam Hazeh, Laman Itavlach, Be'olam Shekulo Tov. It refers to Olam Haba. But from the Pasuk itself, it's not clear which way to read Laman Itavlach. It's not obvious that it means Be'olam Shekulo Tov, but rather it could simply mean the Laman Itavlach, which is that if you do Kibud Av Va'Em, others will do Kibud Av Va'Em for you. And that's what he was uncertain about over here, that Rabbi Chir Ba'aba didn't know whether the Laman Itavlach was really about Ulam Haba, which really is the nature of the question that's being asked over here. The Matzkiz brings a second answer, which is that the Rishonot and Achronot, and this comes from the Tosafot at the top of the second Amud of yesterday's Daf, where Tosafot actually speaks about the fact that the Luchot that are mentioned in Yitro and Luchot and Etchanan are really the same Luchot. And therefore, even if you were to say to me that it's written in the Parshat Etchanan and it's not written in Parshat Yitro, does that really tell me any information? Because the two are recalling the same event. And since they were said simultaneously, as we know, Zachor B'Shamor Nemru B'Dibur Achad, then when you say Lamani Tavlach is only found in the second telling of the Aseret HaDibrot and Etchanan and not in the first telling, I'm not sure that really means that they're only found in Etchanan and not in Yitro, because they really were said simultaneously. That's another possible answer to this question, or why Rabbi Chir Ba'aba was uncertain. But Pnei Yoshua says that question here revolves around whether there's a chisaron in Dibur or chisaron in Ktiva, which means, did Hashem say Lamani Tavlach, and it was just not written, or it wasn't recorded in Yitro, but it is recorded in Etchanan? Or maybe Hashem never said Lamani Tavlach, and therefore the chisaron is not just in the Ktiva, but in the Amira, that Hashem never said it, and it was only written. And that's where he goes to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to clarify that issue as to whether the chisaron is simply a chisaron in Ktiva or chisaron in Amira, that it was never said. So those are other nuanced ways to try to explain the response of Rabbi Chir Ba'aba and not take it literally that he didn't know the answer to this question, or whether Lamani Tavlach was found in the Aseret HaDibrot in Yitro versus those that are found in Parshat Etchanan. So he goes, Azal Legabei, he went to speak to Rabbi Tanchum Bar Chanilai, who was Talmid of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Amalei Mimenu Lo Shamati. So he says, I never heard from Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi about this. Elakach Amar Li Shmuel Bar Nachum, but I did hear from Shmuel Bar Nachum Achi Imo, the uncle of Rav Acha Bar Rabbi Chanina, Vamila Avi Imo Shel, I'm sorry, not the uncle, that is, oh, sorry, yeah, the uncle, Vamila Avi Imo, or some say that it was the maternal grandfather, Shel Rav Achai Bar Rabbi Chanina, Hoil, B'sofan lehishtaber. Since the Ruchot Rishonot were going to be broken in the end, therefore Hashem didn't want to put in the Mani Tavlach in the Luchot Rishonot. So the absence of the Mani Tavlach is because of the fact that they were eventually going to be broken, and therefore that's not something that is Tov. But it says, V'sofan lehishtaber, my Havi. Just because they were going to be broken in the end, what does that change anything? Amar Vashi Chas V'Shalom Paska Tova Mi'Israel. Had it been that the word Tov did appear in the Luchot, and then it was broken, that would have been symbolically a indication that the Tov would have been removed from Kalal Yisrael, and that they would not have that permanent bracha of Tov. And therefore, there is a reason not to have the word Tov appear in the Luchot HaRishonot, because of the fact that if it's broken, that would have negative ramifications for Kalal Yisrael. And as the Marsha notes over here, not only is the word Tov not appear in the first Dibrot, but the letter Tet does not appear at all. And that will parlay us into this next sequence in the Gemara as to the meaning of the letter Tet, which is associated with the Tov that is not written in the Kibud Av Eim of the Dibrot HaRishonot. And through that he explains the original statement of Rav Chir Ba'aba as to, before you ask him about why is the word Tov not there, why don't you ask me about the fact that there's no Tet mentioned in the whole Dibrot HaRishonot? The way that is explained between the Dibrot HaRishonot and the Dibrot HaAchronot, the Maharal and the Chidushi HaGadot, in trying to explain this, says that Luchot HaRishonot, he says, Lo ayu ru'im lifei olam hazeh. They didn't belong to olam hazeh. L'kach lo ne'emar ben tov. Therefore, the word tov does not appear there. Ki me'ilat tov ne'emar ala mitziyot shura'u le'olam. Tov is only a word that's used when you're talking about things in reality, things that are come to fruition in the world, and that is why you find it throughout Maaseh Breshit, the word Tov is used, because that's a reference to the creation and things that are Olam Hazeh. On the other hand, the Luchot HaRishonot, which were the Maaseh Elukim, the word Tov was not appropriate to be fitted in there, and therefore it's not mentioned in Parshat Yitro. But in the Luchot Shniot, which were the Maaseh of Moshe Rabbeinu, since they're the Maaseh of Moshe Rabbeinu, therefore they are Maaseh Adam or Maaseh Olam Hazeh, And for that reason, the word Tov does appear in the Luchot Hashniot. Now, over here, you see the Maral using the interpretation, which is very difficult to say is necessarily true, which is that when we talk about here Dibrot Rishonot and Dibrot Achronot, which are those that found in Yitro and those found in Etchanan, we until now have assumed that they always spoke about the Luchot HaRishonot. Over here, the Maral is saying somewhat along the lines of splitting them not only between the Dibrot Rishonot, Dibrot Achronot, but between the Luchot Rishonot and Luchot Achronot. He's saying it doesn't appear in Yitro, which is the Luchot HaRishonot, and that's because Tov is not applicable to a Maaseh Elokim, versus in the Bet Hanan, where it's a Maaseh of Moshe, there the word Tov does appear. And that seemingly indicates what is written in Be'aretz Etchanan is really a reference or connected to the Luchot Achronot, again, which is a conflation of the terms here between Dibrot Rishonot and Achronot versus Luchot Rishonot and Luchot Achronot. And again, it's not clear that the Gemara is making such a distinction. The Maaretz Chiyut, so the Ramban on the Torah is very against that view, that the Dibrot Rishonot, Dibrot Achronot are referencing the Luchot Rishonot and Achronot, because he says that everything was found in Luchot HaRishonot, and the descriptions in Parshat Etchanan are just expounding or explicating on that which was in Parshat Yitro. And he says specifically about this Pasuk, he just says that the Mani Tavlach is just an additional explanation or Harchava, expansion on what Laman Yerichun Yamecha means, including also Kashir Tzivcha Hashem Lokecha, which is also noted in the Dibrot HaChronot, not Dibrot Rishonot, which is true by Shabbat and by Kibbutz Ve'eim, and he again, says that that's just an explication or a harchava, an expansion of what's written in Parshat Yitro. It's not a completely different dibrot that are found here. The way that the Pnei Yeshua phrases it, based on the question that he asked before, is that's what Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's answer is in the end, that since in the end they were going to be broken, there was only a chisaron ektiva, but not in the amira. In the amira was complete, but the ektiva was missing because they were going to be broken. But that doesn't mean it wasn't said. It was said at both times, and just only when Moshe records it the second time does he include the information that was absent in the first one, Biktiva, even though the Amira was the same through both of them. Obviously, the appeal of that is that why should there be any change in the Luchot, between the Luchot HaRishonot and Luchot Shniot, and the Dibrot Rishonot, Dibrot Achronot are both referencing the Luchot HaRishonot. And so for that reason, if you say that it's in the Amira, not the Ktiva, you're able to overcome that problem. Nevertheless, you do see in this Maharal that there is some sort of conflation of the terms Dibrot Rishonot and Acharonot versus Luchot Rishonot and Luchot Acharonot. The Maaretz Chiyut offers a possible interpretation of what this means, is that based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah that says that Bnei Yisrael did not sin by the Maaseh HaEgel, that they would have lived forever. And therefore, he says, "V'dibrot haRishonot, which are supposedly before Maaseh HaEgel, then in those dibrot haRishonot, there was no need to write l'man yarichon yamecha l'man yitavlach, because they would never have been l'man yitavlach la'olam shekulo tov, because they would never have passed away, they would never have died. Only after the Maaseh HaEgel is it important to write down l'man yitavlach to indicate that you will then benefit in the world to come, or the world that is kulo tov." Because that is already post the Maaseh HaEgel, and therefore the Mani Tavlach is the Olam Shekulo Tov, takes on a different meaning. Now here it's not clear that he's saying, he's talking about Luchot Rishonot and Luchot Achronot, which is somewhat hinted to at what he's saying, but he's saying just within Dibrot Rishonot, Dibrot Achronot, because the Dibrot and Rishonot are obviously written before the Maaseh HaEgel, the Dibrot Achronot are written after the Maaseh HaEgel, and so he could argue that it's true even within the Luchot HaRishonot, but the differences are a result of the events that transpired. And again, then you'd have to explain why they don't or don't appear in the Dibrot HaRishonot. But it seems from, again, from the Maaretz Chiyut that he's also, similar to the Maral, conflating the terms between Dibrot Rishonot and Achronot versus Luchot Rishonot and Luchot Achronot. You could read the Pnei Yeshua into the Maaretz Chiyut, which is that it was said, the Mani Tavlach was said, but it wasn't relevant, and therefore it wasn't written. But after the fact, it was very relevant, and therefore it's written down, even though, again, they were both, it was given prior to the Ego. So now the Gemara continues and says, Amar Rabbi Yeshua, ha-ur-eh tet b'chalomo siman yafeh lo. Person who sees the letter tet in his dream, that is a good sign, my taima. Im leim mishum dechtiv tov, because tet represents tov, so that's why it's a good sign, ema. We got plenty of words that start with tet that are not so positive, and a number of them appear in Eicha as well, which now we begin the period of the 3 weeks. He says, in Yeshayahu, when it talks about Hashem says, I'm going to come and sweep them away with a broom of destruction. So you see that the letter here, a word that starts with tet, is obviously a very negative connotation. It says, chatet kamrinat. You only saw one tet. The shorish of tetia has two tets in it, so that's not the right word. So ema, let us say from the pasuk in Eicha that says, tum ata bishuleha, that its defilement was in the hem or the base of their dress. So there again, the word tumata is used with the tet. It says, tet bet kamrinan. He didn't see just the tet in the dream. He saw a tet and a bet in the dream. So that would have been from the shorish tov rather than tum'a. But then he says, well, we have other words with tet bet that are also negative. Ema, tov'u ba'aretz she'areha. This is the Midrash Chazal that the walls of Yerushalayim sunk into the ground and let Nebuchadnezzar enter, that he never really had to destroy the walls, that they were already fallen. They sunk for him. So here, tov'u, the word tov'u, is also a tet bet. Ela hoil patach bo akatuv l'tovat chila. The answer is that tet is only used for the first time with regards to tov. Shemi breshit ad vayarlu kim et haor. From the beginning of Sefer Breshit, all the way until the pasuk vayarlu kim et haor ki tov, loktiv tet. The letter tet never appears. And the first time it does appear, it appears with the word tov. And therefore, tet is associated with tov. And if one sees a tet in the dream, here it sounds like they're going back to the original assumption that it was only a tet that he saw in the dream, not necessarily a tet bet, but tet is associated with tov because it's a first cameo appearance in the Torah was associated with the word tov. So that's an important principle in general with regards to being mefaresh, the Tanakh, the Torah, is that it's always important to look at the first time a word appears. Whenever a word, and here at the time at a letter, appears for the first time, it's important to understand the context and the meaning of the word in that situation. Because of the fact that the Torah hasn't given you a previous definition, therefore it's defining the character of the word or the letter in its first appearance. And that's what the Gemara indicates here, that the letter tet is defined by its first appearance with the word tov, and therefore it's having a dream about the letter tet is tov, is something that could be good. This goes back to what we saw in the Maral, that the word tov only refers to things that are ba'olam hazeh, and that's why the word tov, again, is very focused, or the focal point of Maaseh Breshit, that every time God creates something, he uses the term tov to explain it. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, haro'eh hespeid b'chalumo, chasu alav min hashamayim upda'u. A person sees a eulogy in his dream, that they've had mercy on him from the shamayim, and they've redeemed him, meaning that he deserved to die, and that hespeid was going to be about him, but he was saved from that fate, and therefore he's only seeing in his dream the hespeid, but it didn't come to fruition, it didn't come to reality. That's only true if it's written down. Now the way Rashi interprets this is not that there's actually a eulogy that's being said in his dream or told over in his dream, and then you would say here, means that it was a written eulogy, not just an oral eulogy in his dream. Rashi says literally written means hespeid, the word hespeid is written over here. And so the Gemara is saying that it's only a good dream when you see the word hespeid written in your dream. Not that you actually heard the eulogy, but you actually saw the word hespeid that's written there. The Marsha, in commenting on that, says the reason that Rashi had to say that is because Hani mili bichtova, shahei bimkom achet, dein chalom below dvarim, bitelim, vazieh, chas, and pad. So he actually says that the word hespeid is actually a conjugation or contraction of the other words here, which is chasu and pidauhu. So if you put them together, that's how you get to the word hespeid, and that's what he says is the meaning of the word itself being written in the dream, is because the word hespeid contains within it this concept of chasu and pidauhu, and that's why Rashi says that it's really the word hespeid written and not a eulogy itself that's there. Now the Gemara goes back to the Mishnah itself and says, the completion of the Mishnah, the end of the Mishnah is that the Torah, when it uses the word Be'ema or Shor HaMor, is only using them as examples, but not exclusively. And when they do use them, it really means Behemot, Chayot, Ofot, and all living beings, with the exception of man. Amar Reish Lakish, Kan Shana Rabbi. By the fact that in this Mishnah, Rabbi says that Ofot are included in all these halachot, therefore Rabbi is telling us, Tarnagol, Tavas, Upasione, Kilayim Zebezet. These three different species, the Tarnagol, which is a cock, a tavas, which is a peacock, and a pasione, which is a pheasant. You can see that Rashi translates it in a similar manner. Kilayim zebezeh. They are considered to be kilayim. That is because the pasuk now tells us, even though it says behemtecha lo tarbiya kilayim, we learned from the gzer shava, from behemtecha, from kilayim to Shabbat, that behemtecha has a broader definition and doesn't just mean behema, it means behema chayav ofot. But that means ofot are subject to the din of kilayim. As the Balei Tosafot point out over here, there's nothing in Rabbi's statement or in the Mishnah that would tell you that these three species are kilayim zebezeh. Elo, you have to say, v'lo shamine el disur kilayim shayach b'ofot. That's what Tosafot says. The only thing we learn from here is that ofot have a din of kilayim. And that's what Reish Lakish is extrapolating to say, Kan Shana Rabbi Klomar, Kevan Shana Rabbi Yesh Kilayim Bofot. Since Rabbi said there is Kilayim Bofot, therefore these species are considered to be Kilayim. Kimi Zvora Denavshin Yesh Ladat, Shelominim Chalukim Zemize, Venam Minachad. And we on our own then can intuit or surmise that these three species will be Kilayim Zebize because of the differences between them. Mar says, Pshita, of course there are three different species, of course they're kilayim. Samrav Chaviva Mishom Derabu Bahadei Hadodi. Because now the word rabu can be used in different meanings. One possibility of rabu means that they grow up together, meaning that they are raised together. The other one could be from the word Rivi'ah, which means that they procreate with each other. So the truth is that both of them may be true, and it could be referencing either one of them, that these species, when they are brought up together, especially when they're domesticated, they tend to crossbreed between themselves. So despite the fact that they can't crossbreed between themselves, there still are kilayim zebezeh. Others suggest that Rabu Badadi is that they're brought up together. Not that they're kept in the same pen or the same cage and brought up together, but sometimes one species will bring up the young of the other species. And so that they'll actually help them to grow and bring them up as if they were their parents. And so therefore, that's why you would think maybe they are not considered a separate species. And that's what the Kamash Malan is, that they are a separate species and they're not considered to be one species, even though they're under the same, I would say, category or under the same genus in terms of the species. So now, Amar Shmuel, Avaz, Vavazabar, a goose and a wild goose, Kilayim Zebezeh, they are considered to be Kilayim one with the other. So even though they carry the same name, and truthfully, they are very similar in nature, there are differences between them. The differences are significant enough, according to Chazal, to say that they are kilayim zebezeh. Matkiv la rova bar Rav Chanan my time. What's the reason that they're considered to be different? Ilay meshum dehai arich ko'ei v'hai zutar ko'ei. If you say, Rashi translates here the word ko'ei, if you look inside, as a beak. It means the beak of the animal. One of them is long, and one of them is short. Meaning that, is that the difference between them? One's beak is long and one beak is short. El Miata, if that's the case, Gamla Parsav, Gamla Tayo, if you have a camel, which is a Persian camel, and a Gamla Tayo, and you have an Arabian camel, Tahay Alim Koei, Fahay Katin Koei. One of them has, now, here again, the translation is not clear about it. Rashi says, Alim Koei is that Savro Av. Its neck is very thick, or you could say that it's big, the animal's bigger. Versus the other one, Haikatin Koei, the other one has a neck that is thinner. So even though Rashi translates Koei by the bird to be beak, over here he translates by the camel Koei to mean the neck. There are those that say that the Koei in both cases refers to the neck of the animal, and therefore the description by the geese would be that one of them has a long neck and one of them has a short neck. And then similarly here by the gamalim, by the camels, talking about a longer or thicker neck versus a thinner neck. And that is the difference between these two species of camels, the Arabian camel versus the Persian camel. If that's the case, Dabu Kilayim Zebezeh. They should also be Kilayim one with the other. And that, the Gemara is unwilling to accept. It thinks that those camels are all under one species, and therefore they're not Kilayim. And so now it has to come up with a different distinction between the wild goose and the regular domesticated goose. El Amar Abaye, Zeb Beitzav Mi Bechutz, Vezeb Beitzav Mi Mifnim. The genitalia of the goose is different for the domesticated goose versus the wild goose. The wild goose's genitals are more visible. Even though they both have them, they're just much more visible from the outside, and therefore they are different species because of this difference in their appearance. Rapapa amar hatuna chada bi'ata b'shichla, that one of them only gives a single egg for every clutch. Matuna kama bi'ata b'shichla, the other one gives multiple eggs in a single clutch. So the difference between, again, the wild goose, which only lays one egg per clutch, versus the domesticated goose that would lay numerous eggs per clutch, that would also be a distinction between them. Not only just the difference between whether they're beitzim or bibifnim or bimachutz, more visible or less visible. But there are these differences, and it happens to be that all of them are true. Everything the Gemara mentioned here is true. The difference between wild geese and domesticated geese, which is the fact that their beitzim are more visible on the wild geese. The wild geese only lay one egg per clutch, and the fact that the wild geese have longer necks. All of those are true. But the Gemara, on a composite basis or compounding those issues, seems to indicate that these are two different species, unlike the gamal, unlike the camel, where the Arabian camel is thinner and more for travel, versus the Persian camel, which is thicker, heavier, and stronger, which was used for carrying loads and for transporting large items. Nevertheless, those are considered to be one species despite those slight nuances and difference. The Gemara says by the camels that they are considered to be the same, by the geese it considers them different. So the Gemara sees, because of the compounding differences that exist between them, that that's sufficient already to deem them a different species, even though today, I think in modern science, they are not considered to be separate species. They're under the same category of species. But for camels, and like you're suggesting, all these different breeds of cows, they are all considered to be one species. So you'd have to come up with a number identifying differences between them in order to classify them as different species. And Chazal did not see that by the camels, but did see that by the geese. And obviously, even though you have different types of cows, they still see them as being all one species. All right, Amar Rabbi Yirmi, Amar Reish Lakish. Amar Bia Shnei Minim Shebiyam Lokeh. Any person who crossbreeds between two different types of, call them animals of the sea, he does get malkot. Now here, the girsa in the Gemara is shnei minim shebayam, which Tosafot favors such a girsa. The way that he had it in the Gemara, it seems like they had girsot that read dagim shebayam, the fish of the sea. Tosafot does not like that, because the Gemara in other places says that there is no such thing as harba'ah, or crossbreeding between different species of fish, because you can't really crossbreed them. And so therefore the whole din of Isur Kilayim of Harba'ah, Behem Techalot Terbiya Kilayim, does not apply by fish. And therefore he favors the girsa that we have, which is Shnei Minim Shebayam, which would refer to other sea animals besides fish themselves, which he does think have a problem of Kilayim. So my time, Amar Rav Adar Bahava, Mishmei De'ula, Ache Limineu, Limineu Miyabasha. In Maseh Bereishit, when it refers to the fish of the sea, as well as to the animals of the dry land, in both cases it uses the term Limineu, to their species, meaning that each one to their species. And so therefore, just like by the Yabasha, those that are on the dry land, there is a problem of Behem Techalo Tarbiya Kilayim, so too by the fish of the sea, since it says Limineu, that they should keep to their species, the same restriction applies. Now, that does raise an issue, because then, why does the Gemara need the whole Reboy that we spoke about before? Behem Techalo Tarbiya Kilayim, the Gemara had a Gzer Shava, Behem Techa, to the Behema of Shabbat, to teach you that it includes not only Behema, but also Of and Chayot. Why do I need that at all if I have Limineu? Limineu is written by the Ofot, it's written by the fish, it's written by the animals. If that word is sufficient to tell us that there is a difference in species that you're not allowed to override, then why do I need the Gzer Shabbat from Shabbat if I could already get that out of my Sebri sheet? So Tosafot over here discusses that issue. First of all, it is a machloket amongst the Tanaim as to whether the Isur of Kilayim applies to Bnei Noach or only to Jews. So that's the first machloket. If it applies to Bnei Noach, it's much easier to say that the Mineu of Maaseh Bereishit is the source for the fact that there is an Isur of Kilayim. If you say it does not apply to Bnei Noach, only to Bnei Yisrael, then it's easier to understand why it is that the Maaseh Bereishit cannot be the source. But if that's the case, if Maaseh Bereishit can't be the source, then how are you using the Mineu at all? So there, Tosafot says that even according to the Chachamim, who believe that the Isur Kilayim only applies to Jews and not to Bnei Noach, you could still use Maaseh Bereishit, not to teach you the Ikar Din, but to give you reference as to what is considered a separate species, or how to define species. Does it apply to fish? Does it apply to birds? Does it apply to behemoth? The answer is yes, from Limineu. How exactly that goes about, and where the Isur applies, that's learned from Behem Techalo Tarbiya Kilayim. So you would need Behem Techalo Tarbiya Kilayim to tell you about the Isur. Once you have the Isur, then you can go to Maaseh Bereishit to look and see where does the Torah specify or demand a separation of species. And that's learned out from the word Limineu. There are others, I think, like the Ravid, who suggest here that the difference might be in the nature of the Isur. that b'minehu from Maaseh Bereishit only teaches you a mitzvah aseh, which is a positive commandment that you must separate between the species. In order to have a lav and negative commandment, that's what you need behem techalo tarbiyah kilayim for, and the limud there, that behemah, applies to more broader context than behemah itself, including chayot and ofot. So that's why you need the limineu to teach you the mitzvah aseh. You need the behem techalo tarbiyah kilayim, and to be more inclusive, to make it an iser lav for all of these items. So that's how others deal with this problem of the overlap between limineu and behem techalo tarbiyah kilayim. Now, Tosafot over here says, why do you need limineu at all? Why don't we say you learn it out of Shabbat? Why don't we just learn it out of Shabbat? Shabbat includes everything, so why aren't the fish included from Shabbat? So Tosafot says over here, Mishabbat lo matzi de melef, de mi ribuy de chol behem techa, leit lan ribuye. The chol behem techa would not include fish. Elokol mili di abesha, only things on dry land. Shadam ragil lechamer acharim, things that people usually drive or utilize for their work on the yabasha, on the dry land. Those are the things that are included in the pasuk of chol behem techa. Because when we're talking about malacha on Shabbat, we're talking about the normal things that people do or are engaged in on Shabbat. And so if that's the case, fish of the sea or animals of the sea are not where they're doing their malacha, and it's not where they are going to drive the animals to do malacha for them. And so for that reason, he says Shabbat itself is not sufficient to teach you about the dagim. You need lemineu and the gezerah shava, lemineu, as found in my Maaseh Bereishit, to teach you about the fish, which would not come out of him to chalut tarbiya kilayim. By rachva, a manig biza v'shivuta mahu. A person who is driving, Rashi says here, his wagon, and the wagon is being pulled by a goat on the dry land, and it's tied to a fish, a shivuta, which is probably like a mullet, which is a large fish that is found in the rivers in Bavel, that was also tied on, and the fish is swimming in the river, and the ace is walking on the side, and they're both pulling along this guy's wagon. I mean, I think that the other option might be better, which is that if he has a ship, he has his ship in the river, and he has a fish that's tied to it that's pulling him along, and he also has an ace that's tied that's walking along the banks pulling it along, that also could be the same question, which is you have these two animals that are pulling it together. Mi Arminan came into Iza lo nochit b'yam v'shivuto lo selek b'yam v'shah. Do we say because the goat never goes into the water or doesn't live in the water, and the shivuta never lives on dry land, lo klum avid? There's no iser here of lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav, that you're not allowed to put together two animals to work for you in a single harness or a single work position. So over here it won't matter because these are not overlapping behemoth because they'll never spend time in each other's environment. Odilma hashta mia kamanik, or do we just say they're both pulling, they're both doing the work, and that's enough to be called kilayim? If a guy puts in his hand wheat and barley, then he puts the chita down in Eretz Yisrael, and the sora in chutz laaretz, according to your reasoning, would you be chayav in that case? So there you see that when you have two things that never overlap, the chita is in Eretz Yisrael, the sora is in chutz laaretz, and so we wouldn't consider them to be too close together, or kilayim, because one is on this side of the border and one is on that side of the border. The border itself separates between them, and that's enough of separation. So why don't we say the same thing by the fish and the ace? There's a border between their habitats, between that which is in the water and the habitat of those that are on the land, and the two don't cross over. So there should be a fixed line that sits between them that would separate between the fish and the ace. And therefore, they should not be considered to be kilayim here, just like chita and sora, when they're put down together, are not considered to be kilayim. Now, we're talking about chita and sora over here. Tosafot points out, it's actually Tosafot the Shitato, that we paskin, in order to be kilaya kerem, you need chita, sora, and chartzan b'mapalat achat. You have to put chita, sora, and chartzan, the grape seed, down in one shot. But if you don't have that, even Rabbi Shaya, who requires that by kilaya kerem, agrees by Kilei Zra'im that it's enough to have Chita V'Sora together, and there is an opinion that you need three minim, three different types, but that is, if he plants Chita and Sora Ke'achad, meaning that he has two Sora or two Chitim together with the other species. But this is referencing the Kilei Zra'im over here, and the placing of them down together is what creates the problem. Now, he's saying, I want to compare these two cases and say that one of the options that you gave by the Shivut and the A's are not reasonable. It's not a real option. Therefore, the answer should be obvious. And he says back to him, Amrei Achyashto. Rachva says back, how can you compare the cases? Over there, Eretz Yisrael is a place where you're chayav in kilayim because it's a mitzvah tuya ba'aretz, versus chutz la'aretz where there is no din of kilayim. So how can you tell me when you have two adjacent pieces of property, one in chutz la'aretz, one in Eretz Yisrael, and you're planting on either side of them? Of course, there's no relationship between what's planted on one side and the other side, because one has a chiyuv in kilayim, one does not have a chiyuv in kilayim. Here, both in the water and on the dry land, each in its own habitat, there is an issue of kilayim. We're asking, can you cross between them? But both of them independently have a chiyuv in kilayim. As opposed to aretz and chutz la'aretz, where there is no chiyuv independently in aretz and in chutz la'aretz, because the chiyuv only exists in Eretz Yisrael. And here we're talking about the requirement that one separate between different species at least a minimum of 3 tefachim. And so here, from the Gemara, it sounds like if you were on the border of Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz, that there would be no such requirement to separate or give that amount of distance, because one would be in an area that is Chayav B'Kilayim and the other one was not. There you could plant them right up against each other as long as you were straddling the border between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. Just to note here, the Rambam in Paskin Halacha, in the conclusion here, the Rambam when he Paskins Halacha to what we learned over here with regards to two species being put together, he writes here, Echad Shor V'chamor, V'chad Kol Shnei Minim, She'echad Tamei V'echad Tahor. Here's the addition of the Rambam, which makes it very problematic. He says, anytime you put two species together, it's problematic, as long as one of them is Tamei, one of them is Tahor. One's a kosher animal, one's a non-kosher animal. Lokei Min HaTorah, then you get Malkot. She'chaya B'chla Be'imahi, Aval. Midivrei sofrim shnei minim shein kilayim b'har ba'ah asurim lachrosh b'hem ke'echad ulemoshchan ulhanigam. He says, but mina derabbanan, any two species that are under the restriction of b'hem techalo tarbiya kilayim will also be under the restriction of lo tachrosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav. So Rambam has a big chiddush over here, which is the fact that the only time it's illegal to join two animals together is when you have a b'hema Torah and a b'hema Timeyah that are put together. That might be what he's referencing to here in terms of the fish and the A's, that the A's is a kosher animal, the fish, the mullet, might not have been a kosher fish. But otherwise, it's very difficult to understand what is the source of the Rambam over here. From our Gemara, it seems obvious that the Gemara thinks that there's an issue of kilayim deoraita with any two species, even if they're two kosher species, nothing to do with kosher and non-kosher. And you have other opinions in the Rishonim, like the Rosh, who says that any shnei minyei behemot lokei aleihem min haTorah. That any two different types of animals, then you're lokei min haTorah. He does not have a difference or differentiation that the Rambam makes over here. So the Radbaz, in explaining this, Rambam says, and that Rabbeinu came into Afinan shor mi Shabbat. Since the source for this whole din of kilayim comes from Shabbat, tasot kol beimah v'chaya kishor v'chamor, to tell you that shor v'chamor are just examples and not exclusive. Therefore, she'echad tor v'echad tamei b'inan l'chayvo malkot. Therefore, we need it to be one kosher, one no kosher v'chayav, aval, bet minei beima Torah, o bet minei beima tamei'ah, en iser ela mi derabanan. So he says, the fact that we learned this out from Shabbat, and in Shabbat, the examples that are used are shor v'chamor, which are animals that are kasher and tamei, meaning the shor, which is kasher, and the chamor that is tamei, that gives you the paradigm by which you're going to govern the kilayim over here. The Radbaz says that's the source for the Rambam Shita here, that the only time it's called considered to be kilayim when it comes to working animals together is in a case where it's a kosher animal and a non-kosher animal that are hooked up or hitched up together, but if it's two kosher animals or two non-kosher animals, that it would be fine even though they are of different species, and that derives from the fact that shor v'chamor are the example by Shabbat from which we learn all these dinim over here. Okay, with that we end the fifth perek, Adron Alach, Shosh Nagach et Hapara. Now we begin the sixth perek. The sixth perek seems to be a throwback to what we learned before, which is Hakoneh Tzon Nadir. All of a sudden we're talking about dinim or avot nizikin that we seemingly have passed already. We just dealt with boar over the last perek and a perek and a half. And before that, we were dealing with shor. All of a sudden here, it seems like we're coming back to shor after we dealt with boar. And so the Baal HaTosafot asks over here, Zehaya ra'oi lishnot da'el ba'adei mili de shor. This Mishnah or this Perek should have belonged all the way back there when it dealt with shor. And what is it doing over here? So the first answer that he gives is, since it talked over there about a shore that falls into a bore and causes the water to go putrid, so Tana Bashrei Milei the bore. Since we got into a segue into bore, the Mishnayot figured out, let's get the old bore done, and then we'll come back and deal with shore again. So according to this first answer, Eino Chanami, this belongs together with shore, but we just had an interruption, and we were sidetracked for a short time with bore, because of the introduction of bore in the dinim of shor, and then from that it parlayed into a whole series of halachot about bore, and now we're returning back to our original program, which is that about shor. Inami, he says, mile de bore ra'oi lishnot chila, kodem shishneh dinei shmira. Says the difference here is that we're no longer speaking about shor and the nezek itself, but we're talking about the preventative measures one has to take in order to prevent any nizikin from happening. And so therefore, that's what's being discussed over here, and that's why it's appropriate to be discussed after bor for that reason. And so, esh should have also been earlier. Since it said by bor that you covered it properly, that was the end of the Mishnayot that we saw before, here it gets into what's proper preventative measures, and therefore it comes back to discuss according to Nadir, and then only afterwards goes to discuss esh and the other items. So the Balei Tosafot suggests either this bor was the interruption, and here we're just in the continuum of shor, or the other way around, that bor was appropriate to be there, and esh should have also been there. But this is actually what's being interjected, or this is the segue, because we're dealing with shmirah. So the Gemara says, let's deal with shmirah, let's finish off the shmirah issues, and this deals with shmirah of a tzon, or a shor. So there's a konei tzon nadir, someone who puts a tzon, which is any of these grazing animals, like the goats and sheep, into a corral, and he locked it up properly in there, and then it goes out and does damage, patur. He's patur, as Rashi says, what other option do you want him to do? He locked it up properly, he did what was incumbent upon him, we can't hold him liable if he does the proper preventive measures. If he does not lock it up properly, and then it goes down and does damage, chayav. Then he's obviously going to be liable for what the animal does in damage, because he was a posheya. He was negligent in not locking up the animal properly. Nifritza balayla, if it broke out at night, oshib partzua and listim, or the listim broke it out at night, v'yatzave ezika, goes out and does damage, patur. In that case, he is patur. Now, Tosfot over here speaks about the chiddush in each one of these items. He says, nifritza balayla, the chiddush here is that Habayom, the diuk is that during the daytime, chayav, he would be responsible to go get the animal, the kala itle, the milta, because it's something that people know about. I mean, it's information that spreads quickly, and he will be made aware of the fact that his animal's out there, and therefore he would go to get it. And so, mistama yodosh nifritza, so we can assume by default he knows that his animal escaped, and therefore we're going to hold him culpable for it. On the other hand, at night, there's nobody around for to spread the rumors or get the information to you. And so therefore we will not assume that you know about it, and that's why you're not chayav. So in that case, the chiyuv really stems from what we assume you know. In the daytime, we assume you know about it, therefore you're responsible. At night, we don't assume you know about it. But that indicates that if not at night you did know about it, you'd have to go out and close it up, and you'd be held culpable. And maybe the same is true in the day if you did not know about it. Inami, he gives a second answer. Balayla afilo no dalo. Even if he finds out the information at night that it was broken out, we do not obligate him to go and corral the animal at night. It's just too hard. It's too difficult for him to chase down his animal at night. And therefore, even if he has the information, we don't make him go out and do it. But during the daytime, as soon as he's aware of it, we're going to make him go out and take care of it. If he doesn't take care of it, he's going to be responsible, because during the day, that's a reasonable request to have him go back and corral his animal in. And then, partzu al listim, tells what says over here, itzva chashmina and dafilo listim turim, kishlo itziyu. That here, not only is the balabait patur, of course he didn't do anything, but even the listim that broke the wall down, they are p'turim over here, because they only broke the wall down, they did not carry the animal out, and for that reason they're considered to be grama, and grama mizikim is patur. But on the other hand, utziu listim, if the listim themselves took the animal out, listim chayavim, the listim now become culpable or liable for all the damage that is done. And nicha b'chama, if you left it in the corral, locked it up properly, but he left it in the sun, or he gave it to a cheresh shotev katan, and then it went out and did damage, chayav. In that case, he is chayav because he was irresponsible in his behavior. The guys are putting it in the sun, the animal is going to be so tormented by being put in the sun or left in the sun, that the animal is going to do anything it can to get out of there. And that means the animal will become like a super animal, and therefore locking it up in a regular manner is not going to suffice in this case, because the animal has such an impetus to get out of there that he will do it at even extraordinary measures. And so therefore you didn't take the proper precautions. We already spoke about this earlier in the Masechta, Machloket Rashi and Tosafot, as to what the failure is by Cheresh Otevet Katan. Is the failure here that you're negligent in the Shmirah because you gave it to them? Or the Balei Tosafot suggested that giving it to the Cheresh Otevet Katan is not even a problem of a lack of Shmirah, it's a problem is that they accelerate the problem. That they are the types of individuals who would actually cause the animal to do damage because they'll untie it. They will do things that are detrimental to the Shmirah that is in place. So in those cases, if it goes down and does damage, you're going to be chayav. Masra l'ro'eh, if you give it over to a shepherd, nechnas ro'eh tachtav, then the shepherd replaces the balim here, and they step into the shoes of the balim and the responsibility of the balim. Nafla l'gina, if the animal fell into the vegetable patch or into the garden, v'ne'anit, and it goes in and enjoys that, whether it's rolling around and enjoying it as a toldav shein or if it actually eats the items, mishalemet mashne'anit. In that case, he has to pay for the hana'ah that it got, and we spoke about again this early in the Masechta, that over here he pays for the hana'ah and not the damage, the physical damage that was done. Yardaki darka, on the other hand, if it just descended by itself, ve'zika, and then it does damage, mishalemet mashe'zika, it's got to pay for the damage that's done. Because over here, it wasn't an accident that it ended up in this field. It ended up in this field because of somewhat of a negligence on the owner's part that the animal ended up down in the field. And in that case, he's going to be chayav the nezik, not just for the hana'ah. Ketzad mishalemet. How does he pay here? Mashayzika, the damage that's done. Shemim beitza'a botosadeh kama hayta yafa. You look at this field and say, how much was the sa'a worth? Kama hi yafa. And how much is it worth now? So the way that the Gemara is deriving it over here is that you look at the differential in value. We don't look at the particular area that the animal actually damaged, but rather we look at it in the bigger picture as to what was the field worth in its entirety beforehand, and now with this small patch that is damaged, what exactly is the din? And so based on that, you'll get a differential in value. The reason to do that, Rashi says, is because otherwise you're going to hurt the mazik, you're going to overvalue the damage. Now, the reason for that is because the damage here is not damage that is immediately assessable. It's damage about future value, which is that this item, whatever this animal ate, now will not be picked or not come to its full maturity. And because of the damage that the animal did. So when I'm assessing the value, I'm not really assessing the value of an item in its static state right now, or the exact damage that it's done. I'm rather looking at a field that has the potential to produce. And there are items there already, and there are items that are growing, but they will eventually be worth more. So when I'm trying to assess that future value, I have to look at it in the context of the entire field, and not about that patch in particular. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Achla Perot Gmurim, if the items were already fully mature, Mishalamet Perot Gmurim, then you assess it individually or on that part. Again, that's much easier because now you have the fruits that are complete. They just haven't been picked, but you know what their value is. They've made it to their full maturity. They're ready to be picked. They can be sold in the market for a price today. You should have to pay that price that you damaged. Imsa asa, imsa taim, sa taim. Whatever the amount is that you did damage for, that's what you're going to have to pay for over here. As opposed to when it's not mature items, over there you can't pick them today or you can't assess their value today, and therefore it's more appropriate to assess them and their value in the context of the entirety of the field. Now as to the meaning of the word sa'ah over here, Rashi says that the word sa'ah refers to beit sa'ah, which is usually, as Chazal defined, the area of land in which you can plant a sa'ah worth of seeds, which does produce a large amount of produce. And it's hard to understand how an animal is eating that amount of produce. So if you look actually on Daf Nun Chet Amud Bet, there's a very large Tosafot, which is actually referencing our Mishnah. It's Shayach the Mishnah. Over there it says, Shamim Beit Zabo Tosadeh. He brings Rashi's interpretation. He says, Kasha Lari, that he doesn't think that's the right interpretation. Rather, he thinks Sa'ah over here, unlike in other places, which means you planting a Sa'ah worth of seeds. That's the definition of Beit Zah. The definition of Beit Zah or Sa'ah over here is the produce of the field. The field produced a sa'ah's worth. And that's what we're trying to assess over here. And that would make sense, because an animal could easily consume a sa'ah worth of produce. So Rashi sees it as referring to a beit sa'ah. Obviously, this has nafkamina, that's the largeness or the size of what you're trying to assess in the context of what the animal ate. And so Rashi has a much bigger area. A beit sa'ah for Rashi is going to be much larger than the sa'ah of produce that the Balei HaTosafot is speaking about. All right, Tanu Banan. Ezu kiraoi ve'ezu shalo kiraoi. So here we've seen this so many times, and we already know it, but here the Gemara finally says it. What is the proper way to lock up an animal and the improper way to lock up an animal? A gate or a doorway that can stand up to normal weather conditions. That's proper locking it up. Something that can't withstand normal weather conditions or normal circumstances. That is inappropriate locking up. That is pshia. Who is the author of our Mishnah that says that a mu'ad is sufficient with a shmirah p'chuta? Our Mishnah says that he locked it up kira'oi. Kira'oi, based on the definition of the Gemara, means that he just locked it up to withstand normal weather conditions, which in the parlance of the Gemara is a shmirah p'chuta. We've seen before that the three gradations of shmirah, there's shmirah mi'ula, is the highest form of shmirah, which would be something that could even withstand unusual weather conditions. There's a shmirah p'chuta, which is your base level, your normal type of shmirah. And then there's the last level, which is ishmirah. They don't watch it at all. Our Mishnah seems to indicate that shmirah p'chuta would be sufficient. And even though we're talking about a mu'ad over here, how do you know we're talking about a mu'ad? And that the Baal HaTosfot noted, the Gemara is going to say it as well later on, which is menachat tzon. The Mishnah says a kones tzon nadir. Menachat tzon, the emig lot of em keren. Tzon don't usually have keren, and they don't usually do damage with their keren. Elishen v'regel. Their main form of damage is through shen and regel. Shen v'gilot shikav nul azik. They don't normally intend to do damage or have intent for the hezek that they are engaged in. And therefore, this filei gemara hashad the muad the shen v'regel ki muad the keren. The gemara's original assumption, which the gemara will break at some point, is that right now we're speaking about muad. Muad of shen and regel is the equivalent to the muad of keren. And therefore, over here, if it says muad the shen v'regel is only chayav and shmirah p'chuta, that would equate to whoever has the opinion by Karen Mu'ad that you only need a shmirah p'chuta. And that is Rabbi Yehuda that we already saw. We quoted this earlier, the Mishnah, that's not. Kashru ba'ala v'mosera, if the owners tied it up with the reins, v'na'alifanav gara'oi, they locked them up in the normal conditions, v'yatzav ezik, it goes out and does damage, echatam echad mu'ad chayav divi Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says in both those cases you are chayav. He requires a shmirah me'ula, both for tam and mu'ad. If you don't provide that, you're negligent and you're chayav. Yudomer, tam chayav, mu'ad patur. Here we know this from Yudah Shita is somewhat counterintuitive, which is that the tam, you are responsible to have a shmirah me'ula, and therefore, if it's a shmirah p'chuta, you're going to be chayav. Whereas the mu'ad only requires a shmirah p'chuta, and therefore you are patur. The reason being, not what the Gemara quotes over here, the reason we saw earlier was because it's ein ribuy acha ribuy ela lema'et. That the default status of the shor with regards to the shor tam, and then the requirement by the shor mu'ad led Rabbi Yehuda to say that ain riboy acha riboy ela lemayit, to tell you that the shor mu'ad has a lower threshold of shmirah that it needs. It only needs a shmirah p'chuta. We discussed possibly the logic behind that when we discussed this in the Gemara, that once it's known to be a shor mu'ad, then there's less incumbent on the owner to watch it, because other people know about it and are aware of it, then they'll also distance themselves from this animal. Then when it's a short time and other people aren't aware of its behavior, then we place more obligation on the balim to ensure that it doesn't do damage. But here you see that for a shor mu'ad, a shmirah p'chuta is sufficient for Rabbi Yehuda. Shneamar v'lo yishmerenu balav v'shamurhu. It says that the animal wasn't watched. That means that if it was watched at all, that is sufficient. Again, the Baal HaTosafot would say tema. That's not the reasoning. I explained to you the reason before, and this is not what the Gemara said earlier. It seems to be like a shorthand for what the Gemara said before. Rabbi Elazar Omer, ein lo shmirah ela sakin. The only way to guard an animal is to kill it, and therefore it won't be sufficient. Shmirah p'chuta, shmirah mu'ula. No matter what you do, you're always going to be liable for the damage done. So the Gemara says, afilu tema Rabbi Meir. Even Rabbi Meir can be the author of Mishnah. Shani shein v'regel, da Torah mi'ata b'shmiratan. Shane and Regal are different than Karen, and this is what the Tosafot was hinted to before. The Gemara assumed they were the same. Now the Gemara differentiates between Shane and Regal, which are Muadin, versus a Karen that is a Muad. Tamar Rabbi Lazar, V'amri Labi Matnita, Tana Arba'a Divarim, HaTorah Mi'ata B'Shmiratan. There are four things where the Torah takes down the level of Shmirah that is required. Ve'lein, Bor, Ish, Shane, V'Regal. All of these four items require a regular shmirah p'chuta, and that is sufficient in order not to be liable. How do I know this? Bor dichtiv, because by the bor it says, ki yiftach ish bor, o ki yichre ish bor, whether one excavates a pit, or one opens up a pit, v'lo yichasenu, he doesn't cover it up, then he will be chayav, implying that hakisau, had he simply covered it, patur. he would have been patur. Rashi seems to indicate over here, the reason you are patur is because you covered it. Covering, by definition, according to Rashi, is always a shmirah pchuta, and not a shmirah meula. Shmirah meula is to refill the pit in, to refill it, and that would be a shmirah meula. Shmirah pchuta is, by definition, when you put a cover on the top. The Baalei Tosafot are uncomfortable with that because they say that covers come in different qualities. You can have a cover that is as good as filling in the bore, and you can have a cover that is not as good as filling in the bore. He says, so not every cover is automatically a shmirah pchuta. There are some covers that are also a shmirah meula. So what exactly is the limud over here? So the Baalei Tosafot say that the limud comes from the pasuk itself that says that the guy here either excavated or uncovered the bore. And since he uncovered the bore, the uncovering of the bore, usually the cover on the bore is not a shmirah meula. It's just a basic cover that he came by. And since he comes by that basic cover and opens it up, he's liable. As soon as he puts that cover back on, he's not liable. That shows you that any quality cover would suffice over here, and that's a shmirah pchuta would be enough. Eish, with regards to Eish, the Torah says, Shalemi Shalema Mavirat Abe'era, that the person who pays here is the one who causes the fire to spread, the spreader of the fire. Ad David Kein Mavir. The only time that you're going to be chayav is if you do something that is if, or will deem as if you have spread the fire. That means if you do anything to stop the fire from moving, or just put in basic protections, you're not considered to be a mavir. And so that's the sufficient shmirah over there. Shein dichtiv bi'er bisteacher, al David kein ubi'er. That where he, it sounds like he went in and intentionally destroyed or ate up the field. And that's when you're going to be chayav. Regel dichtiv bishilach, that he sent it in. So in those cases, the verbs that are used over here are very active verbs. And because they're such active verbs, we think that that's the only time you're going to be chayav is when you simulate that type of activity, which is that of vishilach or bi'er, which are very active. If you don't do that, meaning if you have any sort of shmirah, that would exempt you from being chayav in these cases, because then you're not acting with such force of bi'er vishilach. B'tanya vishilach zeh regel, chen umer mishalchei regel ashor v'achamor. This goes back to the beginning of the Masechta. How do we know that vishilach refers to regel? Because of the terminology that's used in Yeshayahu, Mishalchei Regel Ashor V'Chamor, so you see that's associated with the animals. Ubi'er Zeh'ashen V'chein Omer Kashe Yiva'er HaGalal Ad Tumo. Again, back on Daf Bet, we discussed how we learned from this Pasuk and why this is referencing to Shein. Taima David Gein Vishilach Ubi'er. It's only because he acted in an active manner. He sent his animal in. He gave his animal to eat. That's when he's Chayav. Halo Avid? Lo, if he doesn't do it in such an active manner, but provides some sort of shmirah, that's enough to garner him an exemption in this case and say that he's not liable. Baalei Tosafot asks, well, don't we use the words ubi'er vishilach for other limudim? I mean, that's what we learned out. And we said there's a tzrichuta back in the Gemara in the first parak as to why we need both of these words. So the Baalei Tosafot say that you have where the pasuk writes is ki yaver ish sadeu cherem. So the word yaver is also there, which is also an active verb, which is what we'll learn it from, meaning that there's multiple verbs over here that imply very active types of destruction, and therefore any type of shmirah will get you off the hook. Amar Rabba matnita nami deka, you can be midayek this out of our Mishnah, diktani tzon. The Mishnah uses the word tzon. Michtei b'shurga askinan ba'ate, until now in the parakim we've been dealing with shur. Nitnei shur, the Mishnah should continue using this word shur. Until now in the Masechta, anytime we wanted an example of an animal, the Mishnah brought the animal shur. Maishna diktani tzon. All of a sudden now, the Mishnah jumped to tzon. Why does it change? La mishum tatara mi atatam bishmiratan. Isn't the reason it is because specifically tzon are associated with shein v'regel, and shein v'regel have a lower threshold or standard of shmirah. And so therefore it's important to write tzon because then we're referencing shein v'regel and not keren. La mishum kan keren, lo ktiva ba, shein v'regel hu dechtiva be. Is that because over here we're referencing to Shein V'Regel particularly and not to Keren? I mean, that's the distinction that's being made here. Shor is appropriate when you want to talk about Keren. You want to talk about Shein V'Regel, you use Tzon as the example. Over here you see that Shein V'Regel are Mu'adim, but they're Mu'adim in a special way or nature, which is that their Shmirah requires a Shmirah Pchuta, and that's why it used the term Tzon over here, which only references the type of damage of Shein V'Regel. And not to Shor, the references to Keren, because the din by Keren would be different. And that's Rabbi Meir Shita. By Keren, you would require a Shmirah Meula. Whereas over here, by Shein V'Regel, you only require a Shmirah Pchuta. And so there, Shmamina, that even Rabbi Meir can be the author of our Mishnah. So that's one way to read the Gemara over here, which is that the conclusion of the Gemara is supportive of the Shita of Rabbi Meir. And the Gemara is saying, Lav Mishum, Dekan, Karen Lok Tivaba, that it intentionally didn't write Karen and did write Shein V'Regel, because this din is unique to Shein V'Regel of the Mute in Shmirah, and not necessarily applicable by a Mu'ad. And therefore, it's supportive of this understanding of the Mishnah with the authorship of Rabbi Meir. On the other hand, there's an alternate view of how to read this last piece of the Gemara, which would then reject this and say that it's not Meduyak like Rabbi Meir, but rather, it can also be like Rabbi Yehuda, and that is the following. Gemara says that you don't have to conclude that there's a diuk in the Mishnah that is like Rabbi Meir, saying that the reason we picked Tzon is because it was Mimi'atza b'shmiratan of Shein V'Regel. Rather, Mishum Dekan Karen Lo Ktivba, Shein V'Regel Hu Dichtivbe. The reason it uses Tzon instead of Shor is because we want to emphasize the Nezek of Shein V'Regel and not that of Karen. V'Kamash Malon. And the conclusion or the reason to do that is to tell us that Shein V'Regel de Mu'adim hu Shmamina. That Shein V'Regel are Mu'adim mitchilatan, unlike Karen, which has a deferred time period in which it becomes a Mu'ad. And therefore, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, the use of the word Tzon over here is appropriate and is not Miduyak neged the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, Shmamina, that's the reason the word Tzon is here, for the emphasis on Shein V'Regel, that the Mu'adim mitchilatan, and not because of mi'ata bishmiratan. All right, now the Gemara says, Tanya, I'm Rabbi Yeshua, arba'a dvarim, ha'oseh otam potur midinei adam, v'chaya bidinei shemaim. There are four items which a person who is not, cannot be brought to court, and cannot be prosecuted about bidinei adam in a court system, but chaya bidinei shemaim. Nevertheless, min shemaim, they're going to hold him culpable or responsible for that which takes place. Ve'eluin, and here are the four examples. One is a parades geder bifnei bemat chamero, someone who knocks down a fence in front of his friend's animal, and that's going to allow the animal to escape now and either do damage or get damaged. A kofev kamato shel chamero bifnei adleika, someone who tips over the bundles of grain of his friend towards the fire. Vesocher edei sheker la'id, someone who hires false witnesses to testify in a case. Someone who knows testimony for his friend and never goes to testify. So in these four cases, you cannot be held accountable in court of law, but in Min HaShemayim, we know that you are, in a sense, a responsible party over here, even though we can't correlate the direct responsibility, so that's a groma. But nevertheless, because of your close ties to the outcome here, we're going to make you responsible b'dinei Shemayim. Amamar, aparetz geder b'fnei b'emat chavero. If a person knocks down a wall in front of his friend's bema, hey chidami, what exactly is the scenario here? Ilema bekoto bari, if you're talking about a really strong, good wall, then b'dini adam namini chayiv. Then he should also be chayav b'dini adam. Over here, there's a machloka between the Rishonim as to what does it mean that they should be chayav b'dini adam over here. Rashi, the Rosh, the Tosafot, all say that it means here that he should be chayav ala kotel. He should be chayav for the wall, the cost of the wall that he knocked down. And so therefore, if it was a kotel bari, then it should have said chayav bidei adam. Not for the animal. The animal you're not going to be chayav for, because it's always groma versus the animal. But the fact that you knocked down a good wall, you should be responsible for that payment of the wall. And therefore the Balei Tosafot would say over here that even though it's not what the case is speaking about, when it says patur midinei adam and chayav bidinei shamayim is about the animal, nevertheless here, if you were really chayav about the wall, it would not be appropriate to say patur midinei adam if that's not really true across the board. So you're chayav for the kotel, so therefore you shouldn't say patur midinei adam, even though the patur midinei adam is referencing the behemah. So that's how the Rashi, the Tosafot, and the Rosh all explain it. On the other hand, the Rambam says that when it says here, it's chayav midinei adam, it's a kotel bari, it means on the behemah itself. That the behemah itself, now you will be responsible for because you took down a kotel bari. Ela bekotel ra'u. The answer is that it's a weakened wall. And the weakened wall that you didn't cost them any money when you knocked it down because the wall was falling anyway and it should have been taken down anyway. So in terms of the wall, according to the Balei HaTosafot, Rashi, that means you're potter the gamre. You're potter the gamre for the behemah because it was groma. You're potter for the wall because the wall itself should have been taken down. And in a sense, you're actually helping him or doing him a favor by taking the wall down because of the fact that it needed to come down. It was a danger for it to be there. Well, then the Rosh says, somewhat along the lines of what you're suggesting, that Chayav B'dinei Shemayim is on both aspects. Chayav B'dinei Shemayim is Chayav for the animal, and he's Chayav for the wall, B'dinei Shemayim. Because even though the wall should have come down, or was going to come down, it still would have lasted another couple of days. And over those couple of days, it would suffice the shmirah that's given by that wall. And for that reason, you are chayav b'dinei shemayim, not only for the beima, but also for the wall itself. On the other hand, the Rambam says that when you say by a kulta ra'ua, you're chayav alav b'dinei adam. Because, remember, the Rambam said before, when the Gemara said chayav b'dinei adam, that was referring to the behema. Over here, you're going to be patur for the behema, but you're still going to be chayav for the wall by the kotel ra'ua. Why should it be that someone who comes in and smashes something that is functional should not be chayav? And therefore, the Rambam believes by kotel ra'ua, you are chayav for taking down the wall. Now, the problem with the sheet of the Rambam is our Mishnah. And that's what compelled Rashi and the other Mefarshim to explain otherwise, is the Mishnah says, patu al listim. If the listim broke down a wall and let the animal go, they are not chayavin for the animal. So why over here all of a sudden does the Rambam say, if you have a kotel bari and the guy knocked it down, that all of a sudden, he's chayav for the damage the animal did. How do you reconcile that with our Mishnah? So that's very problematic. The gra brings down. B'zeh Rambam l'shitato. Shein chiluk ben garmi l'grama. The gra says that this is the Rambam l'shitato. It says that garmi and grama are terms that are used the same way, and there's no differentiation between them. As long as you intended to do damage, that's enough to make you obligated or chayav. And therefore, in our case over here, groma, garmi, doesn't matter. You're going to be chayav for the behema if you knock down a good wall, a kotel bari. On the other hand, by partzu al listim, where there's no kavanah chazik, then you are not chayav. And therefore, difference is, how do we connect between the you do the damage that's done here? So in the case where you break down the wall with the intent to let the animal out, over there it's much easier to connect between the breaking of the wall and the damage that the animal does or the damage that happens to the animal. And therefore we can associate the grom or the garmi with you, and that's why the Rambam says you're chayav. In the Mishnah, what it says in part two, at least steam, the steam have no intent for the animal. They simply want to get into the yard or they want to get in there. They don't care what happens to the animal. So over there it's much harder to connect between their action and the what happens to the animal. And so therefore, that's what we spoke about earlier. Nezek is a question, at least according to one way of formulating it, is how directly can we connect between you and the damage that happened? I mean, does your ownership of this item make it, or does your action or activity make it that you're the responsible party? So in a case where you intend to free the animal, you intend to cause damage to this individual, over there it's much easier to associate with you, and that's our case over here, according to the Rambam. Case of the Mishnah is a case where it's incidental to the activity that they're engaged in, that happens to be the animal gets out. And so in that case, it's real groma where we can't make you chayav, and that will explain the difference in psak for the Rambam. When he bends over the grains in front of the fire, what's the scenario here? If it would have gotten there anyway with a regular wind, then he should be chayav b'dinei adam, because he put it in the way, on harm's way, which is going to be the natural outcome of this fire, which is if it's normal weather conditions, normal wind, the fire is going to spread to this area and burn these items up. He put it into a location which would only get there if it was unusual weather conditions, not in normal weather conditions. So because of that, he's not chayav b'dinei adam, because he didn't engage in an activity that put it into harm's way under normal conditions. But nevertheless, in the end, because of the abnormal conditions happened and it ended up burning down, you were still the one who put it in harm's way. And therefore, b'dinei shemayim, you're going to be chayav. Tosfot over here questions the Gemara's assumption that just because you are bringing something closer or causing them to be in harm's way, that you are chayav. And he brings the cases from the Gemara and Sanhedrin that if you tie someone up, and in the end the sun is going to come there, or in the end it's going to get very cold there, and the person dies, what's going to happen in the future, you're not responsible over there, because the time that you incarcerated or locked the person in place, the damaging agent wasn't there, even though in the end it will end up there. And that's no different than a ruach mitzuya. If that's the case, why are you responsible in this case? So Tosafot differentiates between the cases and says over there, by the case of incarcerating or tying up the individual, you did not move the person's location. They were already located there. You simply locked them into that location. And by locking them into that location, eventually the harm will come to them. In that case, you're considered to be a grama. In our case over here, Rabbi Yeshua's statement specifically says, that he moves the object into harm's way. And therefore, by moving the object into harm's way, that we would be chayab for. And similarly, if you tied up an individual and brought them to a place where the sun would eventually get, or the cold would eventually get, and that's what causes their death, you would be responsible, because even though it's groma in the sense that they harm was not there at the time that you did it, but by mikariv, bringing them closer to harm, that is the equivalent of moving the harm to them. as the Tosfot phrases this way, that we do not differentiate between in chiluk ben mikarev davar etel esh, ben mikarev esh etel davar. We do not differentiate between moving the fire closer to the object that it will destroy, or versus moving the object it will destroy closer to the esh. And so therefore, if you move the individual into a location or into harm's way, you will be responsible. The case where you simply keep it in place, there you're not going to be chayav, that's grom of alma. And that's how that's differentiated from our case over here. Ravashi amar, tamun itmar, mishum deshavya tamun beish. Ravashi says that he made it into tamun, and that's because he made it tamun beish. That this individual did not bring it closer to the fire necessarily. What he did was he covered up the item. And in covering up the item, he made it tamun beish. Tamun beish is patur. So he cost this individual the right to get reimbursed for the nezek that was done, because he now created an object that will not be liable if fire catches to it. So his covering of the object, again, was not the direct reason for the damage that happened here, but it is the reason why the person who did the damage, the person who's responsible for the fire, will not have to pay this individual. So therefore, he's patur mi dinei adam, because he didn't do any direct damage. He wasn't the cause of the fire coming here or spreading to this item or damaging this item. But he is the cause of the loss to the balim of the item, because he made it at tamun beish. And in making it tamun beish, that is something that we know. His action directly caused the loss, even though his action is not damaging in of itself. And for that reason, he's patur mi dinei adam, but chayav bidinei shamayim. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Nun Vav Amud Aleph.